Hello, everyone, and welcome to Our History Project. Folks, as you know, we've been reading the life and travels of John Legend, and we hope that you've enjoyed that book. It's been a fascinating jaunt back to 1828. But this week, I thought we would do something different and go into the Western theater, primarily the Buffalo Soldiers. This is something we have been wanting to do for a long time, and I finally found a contact in Mr. Bill Curtis, who is a regimental sergeant major, and Major Frank Crary. They're joined with me today to talk about the Buffalo Soldiers, not only who they are today, what the regiment that they have is involved with, but also the history pertaining to the Buffalo Soldiers themselves. They're iconic through our history. We had regiments ever since the beginning of the Western Theater campaigns, and they may correct me, it may even be earlier than that, but going through World War I, World War II, Korea, who was synonymous in their statement, their reason for being, whenever they went through, that was their motto, Buffalo. If you'll remember, we talked to Herculano Dias of the 2nd Ranger Company, and he expressed his feelings in this history. Well, before we get any further, let me bring on Mr. Bill Curtis, who's a regimental sergeant major. Mr. Bill.
Yo.
And Major Frank Crary.
Yes, sir.
Frank, how are you guys doing today?
Just fine.
Yeah, pretty good.
Good, good. Now, I called up to actually do the interview, and come to find out most of the regiment is in one location. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, it is. Just because it happened to be that Sunday.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, folks, you may hear people popping in and out, and we'll try to introduce them as best as we can. But we're going to get into the Buffalo Soldier, who they are, what they are, what the vision was, what it is now, and some great projects that's actually going on. Mr. Bill, if I can get you to start us off and tell us a little bit about the 9th Cavalry that you're involved with, the memorial, and the nonprofit organization that you have there.
Okay, well, I guess the very best way to start this off is to let everybody know that the 9th Cav, although it was put together in 1866, it is still an active United States Army unit, and it is recorded as the most decorated regiment in the entire history of the United States Army. Like I said, 1866, that was a year after the end of the Civil War, and you had a whole bunch of folks moving west, especially south of the Mason-Dixon line, because you remember they just lost the war. A lot of them lost family members. They lost property, all of that. So they decided to come west to find a new life. What they didn't realize, and some of them knew it, but they didn't care, was they were encroaching on the home of the Indian, our Native Americans, and especially down in where you had Comanche, Kiowa, Comanche, Lipan, Kickapoo, and Lord have mercy. You had some Yaqui coming up out of old Mexico. Well, at first, these Indians didn't mind sharing, helping these people out. But as in every case, you have some people that have no scruples and get greedy. And next thing you know, there's a fight. Well, there wasn't enough troops because the government was broke. Most of the units in the Civil War were volunteer units, and their time had expired, and these guys wanted to go home. And then they also had the problem of making sure the South got settled back into the Union, so there were a bunch of, well, not just a bunch, the main majority of the regular forces were concentrated down South. So there was very little they could send out west to help these settlers out. Well, thanks to people like Lincoln's former Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, and former Union General Butler, who had become congressmen and senators, they came up with an act, July 28th of 1866, to form four more new regiments of cavalry. And in that act, that formed authorized the formation of the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th, with the stipulation that the last two, the 9th and 10th, would be all black. Now, however, remember, the South just lost the war, and they still got a bunch of senators and congressmen up there making laws and whatever that were kind of PO'd because they just lost their slaves. So after a whole bunch of fighting and scuffling and jumping up and down and screaming at each other, it was included in that act of Congress that all officers commanding the two black regiments had to be white, simply because blacks were not considered intelligent enough to actually command whole bodies of men. And they completely disregarded the record of black volunteers during the Civil War, where we commanded not only our own companies, but regiments and sometimes brigades. So they put that, they okayed that act, and thankfully, the military powers that be chose two of the finest cavalry commanders to come out of the Civil War on the northern side. One was Benjamin Grierson. Originally, he was a school teacher, but Grierson is the one that led that lightning raid down through the South that everybody talks about so much. And the officer that kept his back door closed was Edward Hatch. Hatch was a former sailor, and during the Civil War, he commanded a company in the Iowa Cavalry and later became their commanding officer. And statements were made to the effect that Hatch was hands down the best cavalry commander anyone had ever seen. But Hatch was not one to, I guess, look for pictures and fame and all of that good stuff. You give him a job, he's going to get the job done. The main thing that endeared him to the men that he commanded was not only did he lead from the front, but he did his best to make sure any casualties he had were very, very light. He cared extremely, extremely much for the well-being of the men that served under him. Now, Hatch was prejudiced in one aspect. He was colorblind. He only saw one color, and that was Army blue. If you soldier for that man would risk his life for you. And that's the kind of officer that was asked to put together the 9th Cav. The other thing a lot of people don't know, Custer's 7th Cav was put together in that act, but at first George Custer was asked to put the 9th together. Custer informed everyone that he doesn't serve with blacks, so therefore he refused the position. And I guess it was lucky for him. But in August of 1866, in New Orleans, Louisiana, it was then under the control of former Civil War General Philip Sheridan. A lot of people called him Little Phil, but at that time he was commander of the Department of the Gulf, and the temporary headquarters was in New Orleans, and that's who Colonel Hatch reported to. And he began to put the regiment together in August of 1866. Now, cavalry regiments were authorized a full strength of 1,200 men and officers. Well, Hatch never got that full number. He only had 867. So the rest of that year, they were getting in new recruits, they were getting in new officers, and they were training these people. Now, you will hear, and in a lot of places you'll read, that enlisted men were too illiterate, so they couldn't handle the paperwork and all of this, so the officers had to do double duty. Well, ha-ha, guess what? That happens in anybody's army. It's not a matter of whether you can read and write, but you have to get familiar with these different types of paperwork and your routine and the whole nine yards. And yes, it is a hard job to teach somebody to do that. But nonetheless, the men that came into the 9th, they weren't all ex-slaves. A lot of them were brick masons, saddlers, wagoners, pharmacists, you name it. They weren't all what we term illiterate. So in March of 1867, Hatch received his marching orders. His temporary first duty station was going to be San Antonio, Texas. Most of the regiment went by ferry from New Orleans to land at Brownsville and then marched up to San Antonio, while Hatch and the headquarters company and Van and I believe A and B company marched overland to San Antonio.
Mr. Bill, let me stop you right here real quick.
Sure.
And I'm going to ask Major Frank Carreri. Mr. Frank, the prior to this 1867, let's go back a little bit into the war between the states. Now, were there actually black cavalry units during that time? I'm familiar with the infantry divisions that was put together, but was there actually a cavalry division?
Yes, there were. There was the 5th and 6th Illinois fought in the Civil War.
And do you know where their campaigns were? Was it more Eastern Theater or Western Theater?
Southeastern, Mississippi, Alabama, a lot along the southeastern side of the Mississippi.
Okay.
Eastern okay. Arkansas, in that area.
Now, and what kind of, how can you put this, what kind of spirit, what have you, came over from these troops, and did a lot of these troops actually become part of the 9th and 10th Divisions?
No, well, I don't think there's an actual, probably a affirmative record of exactly okay. the number or names who might have volunteered, since a lot of records have been lost, obviously, over a great period of time. But there were, it was an opportunity for a lot of soldiers from the north, from the Illinois area and that, to basically get their way paid west into the newer territories looking for freedom.
Right. Okay.
Oh, okay. And Greg, there was
yes, sir.
One of the recruiters for the 9th, Major, what is his name? Morrow, commanded an all-black artillery regiment in the Civil War.
Okay. Okay. I was just trying to get some insight on the people that may have come into the 9th Cavalry, what their history was.
Well, and the other thing I found, there is an existing picture of the eight of the senior sergeants that carried Colonel Hatch's body from Fort Niobrara, Nebraska, to Fort Leavenworth for burial. Three of those men had fought in the Civil War, but that's one ongoing project that we're into, trying to locate all of the names of everybody that enlisted in all of the regiments from 1866 to 1902.
Wow, what a project!
Oh
what
Lord, project. Yes.
Well, Mr. Bill, I didn't mean to get you off track there. We were in March of 1867. They had landed at Brownsville and they were headed north. Can you pick the story up from there?
Well, don't let Texans hear you say they were headed north because they'll get upset. But I will relate to you that that is where the 9th Cav got the only black mark to ever appear on their record, and it was a mutiny. And it was caused by one of the troop commanders, a captain. He was a known drunkard. He did not want to serve with blacks. He hated being where he was in the position he held. And he was very cruel. And the mutiny started because he had sentenced a trooper to hang by his thumbs for a day because he thought the trooper wasn't taking care of his horse well enough. Okay. Well, he had gotten drunk the night before, and when he came back to post and here's this trooper standing, hanging up there by his thumb, and he figured he'd go over and give him a fit, so to speak. And he pulled his saber, and he hit the trooper around his neck a couple of times. He cut him. Well, that incensed the rest of them. And First Sergeant Braxton, his company came to him, and they said, you know, we need to go to Lieutenant Colonel Merritt, because at the time, Colonel Hatch had been detached service back to St. Louis to the Freedmen's Bureau, and that put Lieutenant Colonel Merritt in command. So they formed as a company to march to see Lieutenant Merritt, and the drunk officer intercepted them. And words were exchanged. An altercation ensued. The officer tried to strike the sergeant with the saber. The sergeant pulled his pistol, but at that time, the officer of the day came out to see what was going on, and a shot was fired, not from the first sergeant's weapon, but somebody fired a shot. It killed the officer of the day. And as a result, most of the 9th Cav was slated to be released from service. But the need was so great out west that they were given the chance, the charges were nullified, and they were sent west to their very first permanent duty post, which is Fort Stockton, Texas. Now, if you know anything about West Texas, around Fort Stockton, there's nothing for at least 100 miles in any direction.
Okay.
But it is the only freshwater spring right there. It sits in the middle of what used to be called the Great Comanche War Trail. And that's the path the Indians took from Kansas into Old Mexico every spring to do their annual raids, because the Indians hated the Mexicans. You know, it was like, you know, we ain't got nothing to do. Let's go kill some Mexicans.
Oh, my word.
Oh, good Lord, yes. I mean, history ain't pretty, but history is history.
Absolutely.
So they were put there to deter this, and by that time, Colonel Hatch had gotten back, and he sent Lieutenant Colonel Merritt further southwest, 92 miles, to rebuild Fort Davis. So they had a sort of a two-pronged effect on that area. And then they scattered the rest of the companies out from Brownsville all the way to El Paso. Now, if you look at that and figure it out, each individual trooper technically would have had 1,400 miles to patrol as an individual.
Oh, my word.
Oh, yeah. But for 26 years, those men fought, bled, and died in that country to protect the citizens that were moving west, the settlers. And the settlers hated them. They were, you know, mostly ex-Southerners.
And, okay, that would explain it. Okay.
And they had a bitter taste in their mouth. A lot of them had owned slaves. And they didn't like anything in a blue uniform. And then all of a sudden, their protection has a black face in that uniform? Oh, no. There are so many recorded incidents of soldiers being murdered out of hand, their uniforms stripped off of them, the whole nine yards. And still, these men stayed there. They stayed there. They protected these people. And it makes you wonder, what in God's name kind of guts did these guys have to stick to a job like that? $13 a month. When the paymaster showed up. And you were lucky if you got $6 after all of the deductions. And still, they stayed. They became a unit. They are, to me, they're the ones that developed the present-day expression of esprit de corps. You know, pride in your unit, pride in its ability. You know, pride in the people that you serve with.
Right.
And, oh, my God, I mean, some of this will just bring tears in your eyes. Like when two troops were on the way, I believe it was back to San Antone across the old mail route, which went through what used to be Old Fort Lancaster, which is 82 miles southeast of Fort Stockton. Well, they camped there for the night. And they put 5 herd guards out because that's Comanche country. Or during the night, the herd guards disappeared. The bodies weren't found till 3 months later. But that next day, they were attacked by 900 Comancheros. 900 Comancheros.
Wow.
And the Comancheros were usually outlaws, renegade Indians, Mexican bandidos, whatever. But they were some of the most vicious criminals on the border. And they could only come at them from 3 sides. And they actually whipped 900 Comancheros. That was their first major battle. 3 months later, like I said, they found the bodies of the herd guards. And the graves today of those herd guards are well tended. They're on the property owned by a sheep rancher down there. And he periodically looks after those graves.
You know, I've heard it said that in the West that you could quite literally lose your life over a hat.
Oh, God,
or anything insignificant that we would look at today. And so I would imagine it is a completely different breed of character that tamed the West, that was out there during that time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, there's another incident. San Angelo, Texas, wouldn't have existed today if it hadn't been for the intervention of Colonel Grierson. Because during that time, they were stationed at Fort Concho, which was right across the river from the town. And when troopers weren't on duty, a lot of them would go to the different saloons, and they would dance and sing for drinks, or what little coins they could get. Well, this one trooper had been dancing most of the evening, and this one rancher there was drunk out of his mind. Trooper wanted to sit down and take a few minutes rest. The guy told him, "No, I want you to keep dancing." And the trooper was very respectful in saying, "You know, well, sir, if you just give me a few minutes to catch my breath, and I'll do any dance you want." Well, the rancher figured he was being uppity. So he pulled his pistol and shot him in the head. And that almost brought the fort down on the town of San Angelo. A notice
I can imagine.
That the citizens from that day forward had better recognize their right in that town, or that town would no longer exist.
Well, let me ask you this. I know going back in time, and as we said before, it's not a pretty history, but history is history.
Yeah.
The quite common, especially in the South, if an African American was murdered, lynched, just found, you know, regardless of what happened, there was no appeal, there was no rights, there was no trial. If there was, it was a mock trial, just to put on for a show to say, yes, see, we did it. Typically, nothing was ever done with the person who committed these crimes. Was it the same out there, or was there actually some government intervention and or justice that prevailed in some of these cases?
Very little justice. As a matter of fact, there were several times the Colonel Hatch had to hire a civilian lawyer to defeat charges leveled against him for invasion of privacy, taking prisoners that he had no right to do, and all of this because a bunch of ranch hands, for one example, had ambushed a patrol, a seven-man patrol. Three of them were killed. One sergeant managed to get away. They stripped the uniforms and weapons from the bodies and hung them up in the ranch house. And when Colonel Hatch went to investigate and found that in there, he arrested them.
And you have to remember in that time frame, Greg, most of the West was territorial. They would sometimes have two or three governors in a particular state. In particular, the state of Arizona, which a lot of people don't realize, Southern Arizona was actually declared part of the Confederacy during the Civil War and was actually occupied by Southern troops. The southern half of Arizona was split. As the furthest state west that was split, it was actually the South was in control by the Confederates, and the North had a fort up in Prescott, Arizona, which is where then the territorial capital was. And there was actually an engagement here with the 9th Cavalry, or the 8th Cavalry out of Prescott, fighting Civil War troops in an area here southwest of Tucson called Picacho Peak. And they enact that Civil War battle every year here.
Wow. And I appreciate y'all bringing that up, because with us here in the Southeast, you know, our audience is nationwide as well as worldwide.
Certainly.
But from me sitting here in this chair in the Southeast, there's very little that I know about the West, and it's very easy for me to forget about the territories.
Right. Well, now, here's something else that you might want to think about. Today, blacks in America are basically called African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm going to get a lot of flack for saying this, But I am not an African American. I never have been. I have an ancestor that was one. When you walk into the military, this country's military, you are an American. And this
Absolutely.
Is the feeling that went through all of these black regiments. They only wanted to be known as American fighting men. Not colored, not Negro, not African American, none of that. They wanted to be known as American fighting men.
Makes perfect sense.
Oh, yeah. Right. And I think That's there's something that needs to be said about, if you think about this in a way of a term, these men died so that all of us could be free when, in fact, they themselves could never be free.
That's right.
Yes.
And they were
yes.
always first in battle. Always first in battle. You'd have the leash on them to hold them down.
Sergeant Bill and I were talking prior to this interview even about the black troops who fought during World War One and had to go to France in order to actually serve.
Yeah, my uncle.
Yeah, you know, just unreal things that the segregation didn't come about to at the latter part of the Korean War.
Right.
And in the military. But the trial and tribulations that these troops faced on a day-to-day basis is something we can't comprehend in today's market. And you're absolutely right that the form of political speech, the political correctness of the day, of this time frame, it kind of almost diminishes some of what our ancestors were.
That's exactly why we put this memorial organization together.
And while we're on that, let me just ask you this. I was reading over the website, and it said that you, your wife, and Dr. Lawrence
Gaskin,
Lawrence Gaskin, were actually researching the 10th Cavalry.
Right.
When you came across the 9th Cavalry.
Right.
And that's what you developed this regiment about. Why was that? Can you give me some background into what brought the 9th Cavalry to the forefront of your research?
Well, now you're fitting to get into the realm of mysticism.
Well, that's okay.
I honestly can't put that in the words. I mean, the feeling that went through me when I first saw the 10th Cav, my wife had just joined us up, when I first saw them in a parade in downtown Phoenix coming down the street with that red and white guide on, it was like somebody rung a bell. And after like 3, maybe 4 months, they had asked me to teach them dismounted drill and to get them correct on their uniforms. Well, that takes a lot of intensive research for the uniforms, but, you know, my time in service, I ended up as a drill sergeant. So dismounted drill is nothing for me to teach.
Gotcha.
But in that research, I kept running across references to the 9th Cav. And this is where a lot of people get stuck. They only look at one subject. Whereas when you're doing 1800s military history, or I should say military history from 1900 all the way back, you have got to look at all units, black, white, or red, because most of them will have something on another unit. So
right.
You've got to look at all of that to get the right picture. But it was just something about the 9th Cav that just kept sticking to me and sticking to me. And after we put it together, and we've been together for a few years, the feeling just got even more and more intense. And the first journey home ride we did in 2002 back to New Orleans, I was given a soil sample from Vancouver, Washington, and it was from the grave of the only black Buffalo soldier to become an ordnance sergeant, and that was Moses Williams. And I was given that sample to take back to New Orleans because Moses was from New Orleans. And I don't know, something just galvanized right there. And I just recently found out Moses Williams is my ancestor.
Oh, my word.
And he's also a Medal of Honor recipient. And, I mean, wow. Like I said, it's in the realm of mysticism. But the Ninth Cav, everything that they did, everything that those guys thought about when they were fighting or in their off time, that's running through my mind 24/7. I know how they felt. I know what they went through. You know, I relive this every day, every day.
So this was truly a calling for you.
It is. It is. I've told my wife many times, I said, when I take my last breath, it'll be in that uniform.
Absolutely. Now, I was also on your website. Now, you had a quite impressive membership roster.
Oh.
You know, I was looking at, anybody familiar with the Westerns? You had Harry Carey Jr., Rex Allen, Bucks Taylor,
yes.
Herb Jeffries.
Yes.
The list goes on and on. Ben Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
Ben was the first one that we decided to make an honorary colonel. And when we did that, it was at an annual event out here called Festival of the West. And that was the first year that we had been selected as their honor guard and color guard and celebrity escort. And when my wife pinned the unit crest on Ben's coat collar, the man had tears in his eyes and he hugged her and he says, darling, he says, you know, I've got Oscars and all kinds of awards. He said, this is the best thing anyone has ever done for me. He says, I'll never take this off. And after Ben had passed, you know, we went to his funeral. And sure enough, his agent had made sure that pin was on his coat collar.
Right. Yeah, and I know a lot of our younger listeners are going to be saying, Ben who? But the difference between Mr. Ben and a lot of your other people of notoriety out there, Ben, first and foremost, was a cowboy.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
He knew the ways of the West. He knew the drive. He knew horses. He knew cattle. I mean, he was a cowboy first and an actor last.
Now, here's a little something funny about Ben and Harry Carey Jr., because, you know, they were the best of friends.
Yes.
And how they met, Harry wasn't too long out of the Navy, and he had to support his family. And he had gotten a job as an extra. And it was a John Ford film, and I can't really remember the name of the film, but it was during the break, and Ben was sitting out there on his horse, Hank, and John Ford was PO'd about something, and he happened to turn around, and Harry was standing there, and Harry said, John asked me, he says, you know how to ride? And Harry said, well, yes, sir, Mr. Ford. He said, you see that cowboy out there? He said, yes, sir, Mr. Ford. He says, go out there and get up behind him. Yes, sir, Mr. Ford. So Harry's running out there, and all the time he's thinking, I don't know a darn thing about a horse. This is going to get me fired. No. searchers. That's right. It was the searchers.
Right, yes.
So he ran up to Ben, and he says, Mr. Ford told me to get up behind you, and I don't know a darn thing about this. And Ben says, well, don't worry about it. I'll give you a hand up. And he reached down and pulled him up behind him. And they were lifelong friends from that day on.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, because they were always synonymous with the John Wayne crowd and the John Ford crowd. Absolutely.
Oh, and a lot of people get John Wayne wrong and John Ford. If you know your history, you look at a lot of those cavalry movies. A lot of them come from the regimental returns of the Ninth Cav.
Really?
But you have to remember, at that time period, you in the movie industry did not take a chance on ruining your career by putting a black up as the star of a movie.
Right.
But John Ford was so talented that he did one movie that still people don't really look at. And it was called Sergeant Rutledge. It actually starred Woody Strode. But Woody Strode was not billed as the star of the movie. But you get into that, and you see the intensity in Woody Strode's role. He was playing First Sergeant Braxton Rutledge, who was on trial for murder. And in the end, it was found that the storekeeper actually committed the murder, and he was acquitted. But if you go into the regimental returns and the court-martial returns, that whole movie follows the court martial exact, almost word for word.
Wow. Wow. We knew Ford was a visionary. I remember one story, and I'm sorry to get off track on this, and I'll get us back on track.
Oh, you are.
There was a film crew. They was doing an interview with another director, and I, for the life of me, I cannot remember the name right offhand. But he would always say he was so amazed at Ford that they would go out in the desert and they would shoot and shoot and shoot, try to get the scene right.
Uh-huh.
And he described this one time that they took a break for lunch. At the time that they took a break for lunch, Ford's crew came up. They went up the hill, set up their stuff, set the wagon on fire, rolled it downhill. It tumbled, did everything, had the scenes already going. And when they got done with lunch, Ford hit the cut. They packed up and left.
Yep.
But that was Ford.
Yeah, John Ford was amazing. And, I mean, he really knew the history of the West. You know, he was a full commander in the Naval Reserve.
Yes.
But he knew the history of the West. He knew the military history. But people have to really look at these movies, and they really have to know what they're looking at. You know, Hollywood is not all lies. And the majority of these actors knew as much as Ford knows. Even today, Tom Selleck, he knows the complete history of the West. He knows the whole history of the Buffalo Soldiers. Sam Elliott, that's another one. You know, they are the direct legacy of Ben Johnson.
Right. And there again, you're getting into an area that I guess everyone, I say probably 38 and above knows.
Yeah.
And everyone 30 and below may not have an idea who we're talking about.
Oh, they're getting the idea. On that, they're getting the idea.
That's great because, you know, there's nothing like the Saturday morning Westerns. You know, I wish more was back at the movie theaters as now, you know.
Yeah.
So now let's get back to the website and your initial page when you come in. Now, you state that we had a lot of members when we first started, but it dropped considerably because people didn't understand what it was to be a part of the Ninth.
Right. Well,
explain a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, when we first got to put this thing together, we decided it would be best if we applied for the tax-exempt status. And, you know, we followed all of the guidelines of the Corporate Commission and the IRS and like that. And of course, it was granted. But people, most of the people that came in here thought it was just like any other tax-exempt organization. You pull money in, you give money out, and blah, 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 blah. And being naive and being in a truck all of my life by myself, I'm trying to accommodate everybody and find out that don't work.
Right.
And so Jeff and I discussed it, and we said, okay, we're going to make this 1800s military complete. No more independent voting, no more independent this. It's going to be as an operating head troop, period. It's a dictatorship. People couldn't take the discipline.
Right.
No, but
because y'all do go out and perform not only ceremonial guards, but you do live history reenactments. You do quite a lot.
We try,
and I want to get into some of that, and also wanting to get into the Journey Home project that you have. But before we go any further, can you give everybody a site on your website address or a phone number they can get a hold of you?
Oh yeah, that's no problem. The website is the number 9, thcavalry.com, 9thcavalry.com. And the phone number, the main phone number here is area code 520-616-9277. Now, if someone wants to reach me directly, my cell phone number is 602-561-3326. And my cell phone stays on 24/7.
Okay. Okay. Well, we thank you for that.
Oh, no problem.
Now, as we're getting into I want to take a break just from the historical part because I want to get in before we run out of time, and I don't have a chance to get it in. Some of the things that you are doing as a company, and Mr. Frank, you can jump in on this as well. I see, and one thing that really turned me on to your company, not only from the historical aspect of the Buffalo Soldiers, but just as we here are at our History Project, are always out in the community talking to people. We're doing presentations. We're going to any events that we can in order to share our history because it is his story, and we're trying to relate that. So in your reenactments, your honor guards, your speaking, let us know kind of what you're doing in that realm.
Well, my God, we got so many things in front of us right now. But our main focus is schools. And, of course, a lot of people have told us that, you know, your best bet is to talk to elementary school kids, because high school kids and college students, they don't want to hear this. And we found that to be absolutely false.
Absolutely.
We've given classes at the University of New Mexico. We've done a couple of classes at ASU. Texas State University, the branch there in El Paso. Oh, Lord. Cheryl's got the whole list. Cheryl is the administrative director of the whole thing.
But you actually do festivals. You do a lot of different events. And one thing I do want to touch on is that you're actually a recognized unit by the U.S. military.
Yeah, that was such a humbling honor for them to do that for us. We were given written permission from the Secretary of the Army and the Chief of Staff of the Army to insert the words United States in our title. No other organization has that authorization.
Now, go back a little bit in time and tell us that story of how that happened and the honors that you received by doing that and some of the things that you've been involved with.
Well, you're going to have to blame my major here. Because he won't tell me exactly, but he was a big part of that.
All right. Mr. Frank, go ahead. Go on, tell us the whole story.
I'll tell you what I can tell you of it. I was in the military. And just through my contacts of military organizations and veterans associations and some people I served with in the military who've obviously gone up through the ranks over the years, we were able to correspond about the mission of the 9th Cavalry and what it was trying to achieve in the way of education of the public and the schools and different government agencies that we've spoken to, federal police officers, different Internal Revenue organizations, things of that nature. We were part of the honor guard for President Bush when he was here in 2001 in Arizona. So we had that honor. And just basically through the education process, they learned of us and kind of took note because there is Fort Huachuca here, which is just south of us, probably 70 miles or so. Mm-hmm. Here in Arizona, which is still the home of the Buffalo Soldiers, and they have an active mounted troop still there at the fort. So just by our deeds, the military started corresponding, and in kind, they eventually came to the decision that the way our organization was run, and that it was a pure military organization, and we wouldn't accept anything other than that. Our training manuals are the original cavalry training manuals. Our close order drill are all from the Army's 1800 books. So it's a little bit different than maybe the modern Army in the way of close order marching and of course the training of horses in the cavalry style. So they bestowed upon us the fact that we could have that honor of being recognized as the official 9th United States Memorial Cavalry, which we, you know, chose to be a very great honor, actually.
Absolutely. Now, Mr. Bill, when we were talking the other night, you described the first time that you went on to a post as a recognized unit. Can you relate that to the rest of our listeners?
Whoa, yeah. That, man, that was a day. We were actually doing the first journey home ride, and our route, you know, took us through Fort Hood, Texas. And we had found out that the active duty 1st and the 9th was stationed there. And they had devolved into, evolved into a scout unit. And my wife had been in touch with the commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel McDonald, and found out that we were coming through. And he asked if we could stop by for a day. So we get to Fort Hood, and actually it was just it was four of us, because everybody couldn't take 3.5 months off to do a horseback ride. But we got to Fort Hood, and we were met by Captain McJilton, who was our
liaison.
And he took us to the baseball field there on post, and he says, "I want you to do me a favor." He says, "I want you to saddle up the horses." And he says, "If you would," he says, "I want you to ride up." It's at the battalion headquarters is only a mile. He says, "Just ride up the street and ride into battalion headquarters." And he says, "The colonel has a small ceremony." I said, "Okay." And as I was saddling Christine up and everything, he says, "You know," he says, "it might interest some of our troops." He says, "If you go across the PT field and go behind that row of barracks, which is actually their front," he says, "I think you're going to be surprised." He says, "There's going to be a lot of troops who want to see you." He says, "Why not go that way?" I said, "Okay." And he says, "When you get to the end of the barracks, you're going to see a Burger King." And he says, "You turn right there at the Burger King, turn left, and that'll take you across the main street right into battalion headquarters." And I'm going, "Burger King?" I said, "I'm going to be off post." He says, "No." And I'm going, "Well, when did they start putting Burger Kings on military posts?" He says, "We got a McDonald's, too." Okay. So, yeah, I went by the barracks, and, I mean, these guys and ladies were coming out, man. And they wanted to pet Christine and know what we were doing. And, God, a lot of them were saluting us. And oh, Jesus. I mean, it was just fantastic. And I got to the Burger King, and it was just a little rise, and I took Christine up that rise. And I saw this black soldier running across the main street. And I really didn't pay attention to him for a couple of seconds. And then I noticed he's kind of looked like he's angling towards me. So I could just kind of kick Christine up into a canter. And so he wouldn't have far to run. And when he got to me, it was a command sergeant major. And he introduced himself, Sergeant Major Smith. And he said, Colonel McDonald had sent him to escort me to the battalion parade ground. And I'm going, "Geez, you're the command sergeant major. I'm just an old veteran." And he looked at me, he looked straight in my eye, and he said, "Sergeant Major McCurtis," he says, "you are representing every sergeant major that has ever worn those stripes." He says, "I wouldn't dare have anybody else do this honor." And that just almost broke me right there. So we went across the street, and I'm talking to him as we're walking along, and we turned right into the battalion parade ground. And oh my God! Not only was the 9th Cav assembled there, but the 8th Cav, which is an all tank unit, and I used to be an old tanker. And as we came onto the parade ground, Command Sergeant Major Sales of the 8th, called everybody to attention and gave them present arms. And Jesus.
I can feel it too. It's okay.
It still kind of gets to me, you know, that I never would have dreamed of an honor like that. And I got to meet everybody in both battalions, but what really surprised me is I had a niece in military service, and he had arranged for her to be there, and I didn't know it.
Oh, wow.
And when I turned around and saw her, I just lost it. And they hosted us for an entire week. And the two sergeant majors got together and said I needed to see how a real tank works. And they took me out on the range, and I got to ride the Sergeant Major Sales tank. Then we went over to the gunnery range, and I got to fire it. But the only other person I know of that's ever had an honor like that bestowed on them was General Creighton Abrams. And that's what our tanks now, that's who our tanks are named after.
Wow. I mean, what a story. I know I had to get you to retell that because it gave me chills the other night and it still gives me chills today. So, great story. I mean, that is a fantastic story. Now, let's talk a little bit about the journey home. I know we've mentioned it. We've given some tidbits on the project itself. But let's go a little bit in depth of the journey home, what it is, and how it's put together, and what it is all about.
Okay, well, originally, it was me and my lieutenant sitting here, and another former captain that used to be with us. His job's taking him away from us right now. But we were sitting around talking one day and trying to figure out how to promote this organization and get the word out and get the history out. And my lieutenant, who we call Animal, he said, you know, we ought to do a ride. And I'm going, yeah, we could do a ride, you know. Where are we going to go? Fort Huachuca. Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, we could do that. Yeah, I need something a little bit more. So we kicked it around a little bit. So Animal pops up and he says, that'd be something if we rode to New Orleans. And I looked at him like, you just lost your mind. That's 2,600 plus miles. And we talked a little bit more, and then we left it for about a year. And then July of 2002. I don't know, I was frustrated about something. And I got up one morning, I just happened to be in, got on the computer, and my wife got up, she fixed some coffee, and I said, you know what, I'm going to New Orleans. Let me call Animal and see what we can do with this. So we kicked it around, and the more I thought about it, the more I said, yeah, I'm going to do this. That's going to bring attention to the 9th Cav. So I was looking for horses because we don't own our horses. We rent them. And we have two steady suppliers. But the closer it got to September 1st, I'm still without a horse. But earlier I had met one of the most gracious ladies you would ever want to meet. Her name is Lynn Anderson. She is famous for her song, I Beg Your Pardon, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden.
Yes.
And she loves our troops. She would do anything in the world for our troops. And me and Lynn became really good friends. And she had heard that I was going to do this. And 2 days before I took off, she called me from Taos, New Mexico, where she lives. She said, Bill, she said, do you have a horse yet? I said, no, sweetheart. I said, I'm not really worried about it. I said, I've got a haversack and I can put together a knapsack, just like it did in Cuba. I said, I'm going to leave here September 1st. If I've got to leave here, walk it. I said, somewhere, I'm going to get a horse. She said, well, darling, don't you worry about it. She says, I'm not at home. Well, she really wasn't at home. She was in Nashville when she called me. She says, some way, I'm going to try to cut some of this short and get back, and I'm going to trailer my horse down to wherever you are, and you are going to ride my horse to New Orleans. Now, her horse was the stud that founded her registered bloodline. And that horse was worth $150,000. And she
said, "He's a Ferrari."
"With what you're doing," she said, "you deserve to ride the best." And I said, "Lynn, I don't even have insurance." She says, "I don't care. You're going to get this done." But we had another supplier that called me that night, and he says, "Where do you want me to have the horses?" I said, "Dude, I can't pay you. We don't have any money." He says, "Where do you want me to have the horses? We'll talk about payment when you get back. You got to get this done." And sure enough, the next day, he showed up with 7 horses. And I had 2 support vehicles, and we started off. And I guess, and I had that sample from Moses Williams with me. And we made it to Fort Bayard in, 3 weeks? And I didn't know it, but there was a veteran's cemetery on that old post. And that used to be a headquarters for the 9th Cav when they were serving in New Mexico in the 1880s. And I went to that cemetery. And as I walked among the headstones, I noticed there were men buried there from all of the Buffalo Soldier Regiments. There were men buried there from the 135th U.S. Colored Infantry. These guys built Fort Bayard. And it's like all of them were talking to me, every one of them. And that's when I decided maybe I should take a little dirt just to remember these guys. Maybe I should just take them to New Orleans. And that's basically what started it. From being in that cemetery, I just lost all idea of any kind of video or news coverage or anything like that. The only thing I wanted to do was just symbolically get those guys back home, because the regiments never returned to where they were put together. And it, to me, it was just my way of saying thanks in a small way. You know, they rode and fought over that ground. I figured a little horseback ride from Phoenix to New Orleans was the least I could do. And if I could take a little bit of them with me, even better. And that turned out to be the best thing I've ever done in my life.
Well, you talk about a little divine intervention there.
Yeah. It really gets stranger. Because I know my wife had sent out the press releases and notifications and like that. And, of course, something that long, you have setbacks here and there. It ended up with just me and the support drivers and my horse, Christine. And Christine, she was a 6-year-old cow horse. She'd never done parades, been around crowds, none of that. Just chased cows all her life. And everybody along the way, I mean, word of mouth just spread like wildfire. People were bringing us food. They were bringing us feed for the horse. They were giving us gas money, veterinarian services, all of that, just all along the way. And people had told me, "Man, when you get to Texas, you better have plenty of bullets, because they real prejudice over there." And it's like, dude, I'm going among horse people. There's a difference.
Right.
Believe you me, there is a difference. I don't care how prejudiced you are. If you're a horseman, people are going to help you. Other horsemen will come to your aid, I guarantee you. Doesn't make any difference what you believe. But, and even the state police and the local police, they took care of us. When we got to the Louisiana line, we had 2 state police escorts. And we had to go through downtown Lake Charles, Louisiana. And I told the trooper, I said, "Look," I said, "I don't know how Christine's going to react. She's never been put in that kind of situation." He says, "Well, we'll keep everybody back as much as possible, because there really is no other way we can go." I said, "Okay." So we took off and hit downtown, and people were waving and blowing their horns and all like that. And she was just a little nervous, but she got over that real fast, and she was just plodding along. And all of a sudden, she happened to look up, and she saw her reflection in a department store window. And that's the first time I ever seen a horse do a double take. She saw that image, her head came up, and she got a bow in her neck, and that tail came up, and she went to prancing down the street.
Oh, my word.
And from that time on, you couldn't keep her out of a camera. She was just a wonderful, wonderful horse. And the state police took care of us all the way to New Orleans. We slept at their barracks, everything. But unfortunately, it was during their local elections. And the old city regime was going out, and they threw away everything from the new regime threw everything away. So all of our paperwork and stuff got thrown away with it. So they didn't know a thing about it. Well,
oh, no.
We had become friends with a Catholic nun, a little black lady, years ago. She belonged to the oldest order of black nuns in the country, the Sisters of the Holy Family, and they are there in New Orleans. And my wife and Jeff and my vice president and secretary all flew in that Thursday. And I told them what, you know, the dilemma was. We had no place to take the samples. I had collected 167 samples. And my wife said, let me call the sister. She says, I got her number. Let me call her. And I hadn't seen her in like 3 years. So she called the convent and talked for about 10 minutes. And she came back with this big smile. She said, get some rest. Tomorrow morning, we're taking the samples to the convent. They are going to look after them until we can figure out with the city how they're going to be displayed. So the next morning, we get all spiffed up and everything. We pull into the convent. And Jeff and I grab the box with the samples in it. And when we walked in, all of the nuns were there, and the priest from across the street at the school was there in the full thing with the pointy hat and all of that, because the regular priest had just gone on vacation. And they had this altar table there draped in a blue and gold cloth. And the Mother Superior told us to set the box on that table. And the priest blessed the samples and consecrated the box. And we took the box into the chapel, and it rested on the altar the rest of the day. But as everyone was filing out of the chapel, I found out I didn't want to leave. You know, it was like leaving a part of your family.
Right.
And that was the hardest thing to do. I thought I was the last one out of there. But as I turned to go out, on that back row was an older nun. She was dressed all in white. And as I started to pass her, she reached up and she took my hand. And she looked at me and she said, son, she said, I know this is hard for you. She said, we've never met before. She said, but I know your parents. I know where you came from. I know your stepmom comes from Monroe. And I'm looking at her and it's like, ma'am, I don't know. I've never seen you before in your life. How do you know anything about me? And she said, you're not done. And I asked her what she means. She said, what you have done is one of the biggest undertakings that anybody has ever dreamed of, just to honor a bunch of men that served their country. She said, your job's not done. She said, you've got to go get them all. And I looked at her. She said, they are waiting on you. And she said, it doesn't help much. She says, but I'm going to tell you this. Both your mother and your adopted mother and your adopted father are helping you with this. They are with you 100%. She said, the job is tough. It's going to be lonesome. And it's going to break your heart. She says, but you're the only one that can do it. And the rest is history.
Wow. How do you follow up something like that? Are you still doing these journey homes? Is there more in the future?
Oh, yeah. Next year, we'll probably culminate that because, heck, I'm going to be 63 years old this year. And that's a good ride. But we're locating quite a bit of them. We've just got in 150 samples from the Presidio all-knife calf, and the gentleman is going to start on the 10th, the 24th, and the 25th to get those samples there. So altogether, that'll be 450 samples just coming from the Presidio. And the gentleman that's doing that, his name is Walter Mackins. And, you know, he surprised me. He surprised me. He did it beautifully. And then there's another over 400 at the Los Angeles Veterans Cemetery. So we're getting those. We've got some that are going to be coming. Well, yeah, some that are coming from Nebraska. And a lot of the soldiers, the Buffalo soldiers that served at Fort Robinson and Fort Niobrara and were buried in those post cemeteries, when they closed the post, the bodies were moved to just west of Lincoln to the VA cemetery there. And one of the bodies is the first Medal of Honor recipient for the Buffalo soldiers, Emmanuel Stans. So we're going to be getting those samples. And we've had communiques from people all over the Southwest where Buffalo soldiers were buried. Like, there's nine of them buried back in the Eagle Mountains where old Fort Quitman used to be, south of southeast of El Paso. And nobody knows how to get there but some of the older Indians and the older ranchers. And they want to take us back there to collect the soil samples. And there's seven that's in a seasonally dry lake in the middle of New Mexico. One of the New Mexico state troopers is going to take us there when that lake is dry. He says, because you can still see the graves. The water's that clear. So when that dries out, he's going to take us there. We can collect those samples. So, I mean, you know, people are helping from all over. And, you know, the more help we get with this, the better off, you know, we're going to be. And we're going to have instructions on the website on how to collect the samples, because a lot of people would say, well, that's grave desecration. Well, no, it's not. We're just taking a half a teaspoon off the very top of the grave. You don't dig into the grave whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You just put it in a small container and label it with the officer, sergeant, or enlisted man's name, rank, and company. And you put them in, you know, each sample in each individual company. And that's the way we're going to do that. So there'll be instructions shortly up on the website. And you know, whoever knows where a Buffalo soldier is buried, just get in touch with me. And we can get you. If you don't have anything to collect the soil, we'll get it for you and send it to you. Don't have to worry about postage.
And if I could, Craig, interject a little bit for your audience, particularly if they know in their own family histories of anyone who might have served with the Buffalo Soldiers, we would love to hear from them because it just gives us more background resources that we can maybe locate photographs or maybe a burial site that might be at a veteran cemetery we're not even aware of. So there is always that, you know, that we would be absolutely gracious to receive any kind of information like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Now, Frank, going back on that as well, now, I know that your organization, through the missions that y'all are doing, can always use funding, especially through the nonprofit organization.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Song is, not too proud to beg?
Absolutely. Us as Our History Project, we understand that absolutely 100%. What does someone or can anybody come and join your organization?
I'm going to say with reserve scrutiny, because all of our members are prior military,
mm-hmm.
one. But certainly we have, civilian members.
Mm-hmm.
That don't necessarily participate in the military functions, but certainly in a support effort, our ladies' auxiliary, fundraiser events and things like that, we certainly have what we classify as a civilian member.
Right.
Okay. And that is definitely possible, yes.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure that we know there's a place for everybody. There's something you can do. Just lend a hand.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, sir.
Yeah.
You know, it would be kind of, well, obviously you couldn't have women because, well, other than one, because there was a woman who did disguise herself as a male for several years and was a Buffalo Soldier until she was later discovered when she developed an illness in the Colorado area. And that was Kathy Williams, which there's been several books in history written about her. Certainly we have, you know, other members that you just couldn't use them in a military function, which our unit is primarily, its duties are military.
Okay.
So there are plenty of opportunities for other things, though.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we've been talking to Sergeant Major Bill McCurtis and Major Frank Crary. Gentlemen, there are so many questions that I still have floating through my head that an hour has come and gone with, and I still got questions galore. And I know people listening to this will have questions as well. Go to the 9th Memorial Cavalry webpage. And in closing, though, I do want to get from each one of you, is there something we left out of this conversation, or what else do you want them to know that we didn't cover as far as our audience is concerned?
Well, appreciate your soldiers, alive and past, because without them, the freedoms we enjoy today would not be possible.
And we do have active duty members, some in Iraq, some in Afghanistan.
So that would be probably our request, is just honor, even if you are adverse to the military, maybe because of political persuasions, look into your own families.
Yes.
And discover the people in your own heritage that were in the military that gave you, not begrudgingly, but gave you your freedoms.
Now, very good.
Now, before you quit, there's one little incident I wanted to tell you about, and I believe this happened last year. A soldier's body was returned from Iraq, and most people would call him a Latino or a Hispanic, but the kid was a Mexican. He came in the country illegally and found out how to join the United States Army. And he was very proud of the fact that they accepted him. He lost his life in Iraq, fighting for this country. And in his personal possessions, they found copies of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, the Bill of Rights, and he was memorizing these. B, you put that uniform on. You are 100% American. And what sets you above the rest, you are a veteran. You are a soldier. The oath that you take stays with you the rest of your life. It doesn't end when you're no longer on active duty. It governs the rest of your life. So never doubt, people that are listening, never doubt that you've done that military service. There's no question of whether or not you are an American, because you put your life on the line.